Good morning. I was asked to talk about the future of research and development in the context of the future of higher education in Australia, and I decided that I will not talk about the RQF. Because it is about the future, and since it is a CEDAW forum, I actually thought I'll exercise my imagination and really look at what are some of the structural problems facing the funding of research and where the opportunities are. What I will do is I'll talk about some global research trends because they're very important. We cannot escape them. And then I will look at where does research funding come from in Australian universities. And we will see that there are some surprising facts there. And we will find that one area where we can do a lot of work is in actually getting industry and universities to work together, or the end users to work together with industry. In that setting, I'll talk about competitive advantage. I will talk about innovation and services because that's the sector of economy that is growing the fastest, and that's also the sector of economy that universities do the least amount of research. And then I'll talk about some of the challenges to better university-industry interaction. And finally, if we really look at long-term, the relevance of China and India to where our R&D future lies becomes very apparent. China and India are just a way of looking at it. It is actually the Asian region that we inhabit. First, the global research trends. Over the last two decades, there has been a consistent trend away from basic curiosity-driven research to end-user research. End-user research is not necessarily applied research. It actually is research that is outcome-focused. If outcomes require one to do basic research, it involves basic research, it might require applied research, or it might require experimental research. So the shift that has happened is that we have moved from curiosity-driven research to outcome-driven research. Why is this shift happening? Well, the main reason is that in most mature economies in the Western world, the taxpayer dollars are under stress. We essentially have to fund the retirement of the baby boomers and the health care needs of the baby boomers. And until they gracefully exit, we are stuck with the fact that most research will have to address solving society's problems or creating economic opportunity. Now, when you look at research that is solving society's problems or creating economic opportunities, they do not come packaged as a problem in a single discipline like physics or chemistry or mathematics or economics. They often have interdisciplinary angles. And that is another reason that we are finding the shift from discipline-based research to interdisciplinary research, because we are doing outcome-based research. Now, that's where academic research has shifted. Also, something interesting has happened over the last two decades. The nature of corporate research had changed. When I graduated from my PhD, the best thing you could hope for was to get a tenure-track position at MIT or Stanford. And if you didn't get into these two or three institutions, the next best thing was that you try to get a job at Bell Labs or IBM T.J. Watson Research Center or David Sarnoff Research Centers. These corporate giant labs, they did basic research. They did pure research. They produced Nobel Prize winners in physics, in material science, in electrical engineering. But they were also very interesting organizations. You went into these places. You convinced your manager that you wanted to do this curiosity-based research. You did not have to apply for funding, and you went to conferences, presented your papers, and never had to worry about undergraduate students. It was academic heaven. But somehow, during the 1990s, it all shifted. And the Bell Labs today does not exist as we knew it. IBM T.J. Watson is a shadow of its former self. What happened was all corporate research that funded long-term research was actually funded by monopolies. And as the monopolies disappeared, the shareholders did not allow the corporate sector to do anything that did not look at the results next year or the 2 years from now. And because of that, that shift has meant that there are opportunities for universities. Now, there is actually a corporate lab where you can still do curiosity-driven research, and that's Microsoft Research, but that's the closest to a monopoly that we have. What has happened is that the need for long-term research for corporations hasn't gone away. It's just that they cannot persuade Wall Street that they actually have to do this research. So they have started working closely with university. Take the example of Intel. It has opened lablets at Berkeley, University of Washington, Carnegie Mellon, and Cambridge. Look at a company like Novartis. It paid $25 million over 5 years to a department at Berkeley for the right to have a first look at every intellectual property that came out of their department for the five-year period. Look at companies, gigantic companies like Cisco. They have no R&D arm, but what they have done is created an ecosystem of innovation where university researchers do startups and they acquire them. And that's the way, that's their R&D basis. Which means that the opportunity for us to work with industry is significantly higher. But in Australia, it hasn't translated yet. Another trend is revenue from services is increasing, but research is still focused on products, and I'll come to that a bit later. So let's look at funding for research in Australian universities. We report funding in four categories to DEST. One is the Category 1, which is the National Competitive Grant, the Australian Research Council, NHMRC, Rural Development Corporations. Category 2 is public sector end user. So it's public sector money, but it could be the Department of Main Roads, it could be some public sector institution that actually wants a focused research done. Category 3 is industry and international, and Category 4 are the cooperative research centers. Now, Category 2 to 4 are clearly end user focused research. And Category 1, which is supposed to be the basic research, is increasingly becoming end user focused. Rural Development Corporation funding is mostly end-user driven. The growth in ARC linkage grants is end-user driven. You can say that NHMRC is more end-user driven, and if you look at the topics of discovery grants today, they will remind you of topics of linkage grants from a decade ago. The entire world is shifting towards more outcome-driven and end-user-focused research. If we look at the funding, and this is from the AVCC time series data, Universities Australia now, Category 1, over the six-year period, there has been an increase of 79%, no doubt boosted by the Backing Australia's Ability funding. In Category 2, we have seen a surprising increase on public sector end-user-driven research that has been significant, and some of it is because many state government departments have shut down their labs and they have shifted to universities in many states. Category 3 is industry, and that hasn't seen a significant rise. And Category 4 is the CRC. So if we look at it, bulk of the research that happens in Australian universities is actually end-user driven, and Category 1 is also end-user driven. So the challenge is, how do we get this thing to really benefit Australian universities? How do we increase the sense of industry-driven research? Now, to make sure that universities and industry work together, we have to look at certain competitive advantages. Of course, the best way to have competitive advantage in a country is to have critical mass. And Australia has critical mass over sustained funding that it has done for medical research in agriculture and astronomy, and that's great. But the source of ultimate competitive advantage actually comes from our local context. If we want to work with industry, we actually have to work on local problems, because that's what's going to attract industry. And let me give you an example. It's a slightly humorous example. When I was the head of School of Computer Science and Engineering at University of New South Wales, we used to collaborate with NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Arts. NIDA actually employs American accent training coaches because the job prospects of a NIDA graduate increase tremendously if they can speak with an American accent. So they employ American accent training coaches. We had researchers in speech recognition, and they started working together to actually come up with automated tools for accent training in American accent. Now, it's a very difficult problem, and they haven't cracked it yet. But think about the possibility that they crack this problem. This was a unique problem that happened in Australia, in NIDA, which is unlikely to happen elsewhere. But if they are successful, think about all the call centers around the world that will require this technology. So the idea here is that if you solve local problems, you come up with unique innovation that actually acts as a source of comparative advantage that has wider applications. If we solve other people's problem, we are actually starting on the back foot because they have the domain knowledge to solve those problems faster than us. So we have to look at our problems. We have significant levels of comparative advantage if we have to worry about solving Australia's sparseness, our tropical and subtropical context, our domain knowledge in resources and logistics, the need to ensure the future of our coal industry. Australia will be the center of clean coal research over the next decade. Now, this, if we focus on our problems for innovation, it not only engages our industry, but it also is able to attract funding from overseas. Let me give you an example. Boeing Corporation has used the sparseness of Australia to actually look at solving the problem of sparsity or technologies for sparsity in Australia. They have decided to make unmanned air vehicle research for civilian applications in Australia. Two reasons. In Australia, we have need for this technology. You're on the right side of the politics, you want to keep the coast free from aliens. You're on the left side of politics, you want to monitor the environment, you want to detect bushfires. So another advantage is that the Australian civilian authorities allow experimentation in civilian airspace. In America, they do not allow experimentation in airspace, in civilian airspace. So Boeing saw that advantage, and it has decided to invest its unmanned air vehicle research in Australia itself. Again, it is our local context that becomes a source of comparative advantage. Another opportunity in bringing universities and industry together is the growth in services. Most mature economy, 70 to 80% of their economies are actually services oriented. Even a country like India, the share of services in Indian economy is 52% and increasing, and China is also catching up. So if this is where growth is happening, this is where jobs are being created, somehow our research, and mostly academic research, is still product-focused. And what's the reason for that? And the reason is it is very easy to amortize the cost of product research over lots of copies of the product. Think about it. You come up with an intellectual property innovation, you patent it, you create products. If it's a physical product, you set up a factory in China and produce it cheaply and sell lots of copies of it, and the entire cost of research is amortized over lots of copies of product. If it's a software product, you simply run the copy command. But what happens in services? See, I might come up with a clever piece of software that detects fraud in banking transactions. Now, that software is fairly useless unless you actually employ a highly paid consultant who actually can look at the actual context of transactions in a bank and translate that into revenue. So what happens is, when you are coming up with services-based innovation, the only way you can translate that into revenue is by employing lots of people, lots of consultants. And it is very difficult to amortize the cost of that innovation. And that's one of the reasons that universities have shied away from doing a lot of services-oriented research apart from some consulting. The corporate sector actually is beginning to look at it because this is where the revenues are coming from. And I looked at some figures where 30% of the BERD, the business expenditure on R&D in Australia, is actually in services-oriented research. That's significantly more than where academic research happens. Now, how we can address that? And I think we have to first address the nature of commercialization of services. Of course, the first step in commercializing a service-oriented IP is that you consult. But that is not the most optimal way to get the revenues back. Increasingly, we are finding that we have consulting services companies coming out of universities which are like spin-outs. So these companies, they rather than selling a product, they start employing people when they get contracts, and they are actually consulting services company, and that's a very good model of commercialization. But the other problem that happens in commercialization of services is the mindset of our university commercialization managers. They come from product-oriented culture. They actually want to have a piece of IP and exclusively license to someone. Now, when you're in the product business, you can exclusively license IP because a company will pay you the price for exclusively licensing it because they can actually address the entire global market by manufacturing lots of copies of the product. But no one is going to pay you the price for exclusively licensing a services-oriented IP because they simply cannot scale. If they had to look at the entire global demand, they will have to employ hundreds of thousands of consultants. So the model in services-oriented IP commercialization should be non-exclusive licenses, as many as possible. And that's a mindset that we have to get our university commercialization managers onto. And when we start doing that, we will start taking that seriously. We will start attracting industry because that's where their revenue growth is happening. What are some of the challenges? Suppose we have figured out exactly the area that we want to attract industry in, we want to work at their services-oriented problems. There are a couple of challenges that we have to address. One is the cost of end-user research. Australian universities are chronically underestimating the cost of doing research. Earlier we saw Glenn talking about costing education. You haven't seen anything when it comes to costing research. We underestimate the cost of overheads. We underestimate the cost of infrastructure. And it has been made worse by a block grant funding calculation, which actually is a very good thing. But what happens here is that universities are rewarded for attracting industry income in the block grant funding allocation. So if we attract more funding or we win more funding, we get more block grants. So universities compete with each other to charge as little overhead as possible. Now, the block grant allocation for attracting industry income actually was good. It has brought industry and universities closer together, but it also has had a side effect where universities are not charging the full cost of research. On the flip side, industry has become used to highly subsidized research, and trying to get them to change is a very difficult thing. You often find industry partners coming to us paying a fraction of the cost of research, having unrealistic expectations of owning all IP, and that's a situation that simply is not conducive to going ahead. And I think the universities and the academia have to work together to address this. There has to be a better understanding on both sides. And unless we solve this, our interactions will be suboptimal. The second set of issues that arises from significant commercial presence is issues around conflict of interest. Now, balancing academic freedom and commercial interest is a very significant issue. Obviously, if industry is paying for certain piece of research, they want to ensure that their rights are protected. But often we find that industry insists on clauses in contracts that are overly restrictive of academia. And this actually really compromises the university's ability to be independent providers of research. Now, Derek Bok, the former president of Harvard, has said the only way you can solve it, you cannot solve it by asking academics to look out for it. Academics will never look out for it. They just want to get the project done. They just want to sign the contract. They're not interested in what is there in the clause. What we have to do is get university business managers, their performance indicators is not just how much research dollars they process, not what kind of royalty streams they have brought to the university, but also in successfully opposing highly restrictive clauses in contracts. And unless we do that, we are going to find that over time, our independence is going to be compromised, and the independence that community expects us is also going to be compromised. Another is the pressure to protect research very early. Increasingly, we are finding that a small piece of research has been done. It has been done in collaboration with the industry, and industry says protect it. Now, the problem is that, unfortunately, commercialization is like a relay where the final leg, the athlete that runs the final leg, has disproportionate amount of glory, reward, and recognition. And the challenge is that if the athlete that runs the first leg does not pass the baton on, there is a suboptimal outcome for everyone. When you do research, it's very embryonic, and you protect it, no one else sees it. The way science happens is you do research, you put it out in the open, someone else picks up the baton, does some work, then someone else picks up the baton, does some work, and finally it's so close to commercialization that someone makes all the money. Now, this is a very unfair system, but there's no other system that we know. But the insistence of protecting research early is leading to suboptimal outcomes. And this is where the Australian Research Council has to be lauded for going to an open access policy, where universities should make a decision whether they are going to commercialize or not. And if they decide that they are not going to commercialize, they should make publicly funded research available for everyone else to build on. And I think that's something that we have to do. Another issue is managing conflict of interest that is going to become increasingly important. We're all aware of situations where the researchers have done great work. A startup company has been formed. The researcher has shareholding in the startup company. The startup company attracts venture capital funding, subcontracts research back to the university. The researcher is doing the research. There are new negotiations on the new research that is happening. Whose side is the researcher on, the company or the university? Often the university, via its pre-seed fund, often at arm's length distance, invests in the company. Whose side is the university on? And we are entering into quagmires of conflict of interest. Now, the solution is not to stop the researcher from doing the work, because often the researcher is best suited to do the work, and in some cases is the only person in the world that can do the research. But we as a sector have to come up with mechanisms that we confront these conflict of interest, manage them in a transparent way, and only then we can actually work very effectively with industry, but also maintain the confidence that the society has come to expect of us. And finally, because it is long-term, I thought I will talk about the relevance of China in India. When I went to the United States as a graduate student in the mid-80s, there was a book by Paul Kennedy, the Yale historian, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. And there was a fact there that sort of struck in my mind, and I didn't worry about it then, but now it has come back to me. In the 1850s, China, India, and Japan accounted for 52% of the world's economic output. And if things go as they're going, by 2050, they might be back to 52% of the world's net economic output. It just might be the case that 20th century was an aberration. But our viewpoint of the world is always through the prism of 20th century. And there are lessons for both sides. You lose a few technological trends, you lose your standard of living in a few generations, and you make a few right calls, you might get your economic, well-being back. And that's the kind of lesson that we have to learn from this. We're living in a country that is endowed with resources. We have a very good standard of living, but we are also challenged by how do we maintain the standard of living. And this is where the opportunities that are arising in China and India, in our neighborhood, actually provide opportunities for us. The problems of China and India, surely we can solve them better than universities in North America and Europe. We share similar climatic conditions. We are in similar parts of the world. Environmental monitoring, infrastructure management, the diseases of the tropical and subtropical climates. We should be able to compete. And that's where our opportunities are. But the most interesting thing that is going to happen, which is going to get us engaged in China and India, is not because the opportunities are there. What is going to happen is many Australian companies will find that increasingly their revenue is being generated in China and India. When majority of their revenue is being generated in these countries, they will become interested in the end user problems in their marketplace, and they will look at their research providers and get us engaged in these areas. And I think that's a great opportunity. But what else is going to happen? It is actually the source of talent. We're all aware of most American graduate programs would not have survived if it wasn't for the steady stream of PhD students coming out of China and India, especially in life sciences, engineering, and information technology. Now, the reason why American universities, one of the reasons why American universities have done exceedingly well compared to some of their European counterparts, which are equally well-funded, if not better, is because they have left their door open to the finest talent as PhD students, as academic appointments anywhere in the world. The European Union is still only now coming to terms with making its academic positions open around the European Union. You cannot compete in today's world. A Germany cannot create a world-class organization by drawing its top-class talent only from 80 million population base. And this is where Americans have done that. Like in so many things, Australia is somewhere between Europe and America. But I think where we have really failed is in attracting PhD students to Australia. Our level of funding for international PhD students is dismally low. Universities have used PhD, international PhD programs as a source of revenue. No one I know has gone to America to do a PhD and paid the cost of tuition for doing a PhD program. But we still think that somehow PhD programs are going to make money. And then we go and talk to cohorts in different countries and we come up with programs that provide upgrade of skills to bureaucrats, and we see that our PhD program is doing well. We are missing out on the top talent out of Tsinghua, out of the IITs, which are invariably going to the United States. It's not that they don't want to come to us. We have world-class expertise in many areas. They would like to work for us. The number of scholarships available are dismally low. And that's something that is we have to look at as a sector. So finally, in conclusion, competing pressure on taxpayer funds will limit government's ability to fund research. No matter how much we like government to fund research more and more, we have to look at industry, we have to look at end users for expanding the research pie. But in doing that, we actually will stumble upon sources of innovation that will give us our global competitive edge. Australia is going to benefit from this, and I think I'm very hopeful about it. There's something else about the baby boomers gracefully exiting, and that is that Australia benefits from the fact that it is not going to be totally swayed in one direction. Our compulsory voting is going to protect us. In the United States, the baby boomers have given themselves entitlement but never paid the taxes for it. But they will vote en masse to make sure that all dollars go to their health care when time comes for it. Australia will be protected by the fact that everyone votes here, and I think they will not be able to play an exceedingly, powerful role there. And so I'm quite hopeful about Australia. Thank you very much.